From Wheeler Auditorium at the Enoch Pratt Central Library in Baltimore, this is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. It's Tuesday, December 4th, and as part of The Lines Between Us, our year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region, we've just screened here the documentary made in 2003 called Race, The Power of an Illusion. The documentary lays out how public policies and individual decisions shaped inequality over the course of decades. It wrangles at a national level with the issues we're trying to understand with our series, The Lines Between Us, at the regional level. We're kicking off a panel discussion now. Joining me are Diane Bell McCoy, President and CEO of Associated Black Charities. Welcome.
Thank you.
Bishop Douglas Miles, organizer of Baltimore's Koinonia Baptist Church and the clergy co-chair of Baltimoreans United in Leadership Development, or BILD. Welcome.
Welcome.
And Michael Sarbanes, executive director of Baltimore City Public Schools Office of Engagement, also co-chair of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of the Episcopal Diocese of Baltimore. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So let me throw a question out to any of you. This documentary was released in 2003. We've seen a lot in the housing realm in particular in the 9 years since then. The surge of subprime loans, the housing crisis, the collapse of housing values, not to mention the election of our first black president. Have you seen anything in the last 9 years in the area of housing that moves us toward equality of opportunity? Or is this film today an accurate reflection of the system that's in place? Bishop Miles?
I think that, two things. One, we've moved to a place now where there's equality of inopportunity brought on by the banking crisis and what the banks are doing to all of us in terms of interest rates, lack of mortgage lending, primarily for middle-income families. So there is equality of inopportunity in that sense. But I think the damage was done far before the crisis in terms of creating the crisis in inequality by race. And rather than this being really named the power, race, the power of illusion, I think it should be titled Race, the Power of Ingenuity, as to how ingenious the banks were, how ingenious structural racism has been in creating the dilemma we face, particularly those persons of color in this country.
Diane or Michael, any thoughts about this?
One of the most powerful things, I think, in the film is the way it shows the way that advantage and disadvantage accrues over generations. So the fact that this was made in 2003, the things that it's highlighting in terms of wealth accumulation in the way that opportunity has played out over generations will take generations to change. I mean, I don't think there's going to be a big change to be anticipated in just a decade. So I think there are, what it's pointing to is something that is going to take us much longer to work our way out of.
But I guess part of what I'd love to hear your thoughts about is which way the trajectory is going at this point. Because this documentary shows us such an ingrained system of government-devised redlining, of how one generation after another builds on the wealth or lack of wealth of their parents, that it almost makes me think it's impossible to make progress.
I don't know that I believe it's impossible, but I would say that I think that we have a particular opportunity window of time right now. And I'm not sure how long that window will stay open. And I say window of time right now, I'm a fanatic about data. And if you look at where this country is going, the demographic shift, if you look at, as Bishop Miles talks about, the kind of inopportunity equalized for but still very unequal in terms of differences by race. But as we begin to look at where we stand as a country and a global economy, and the dangers of what this historical pattern of institutional and structural racism has done from an economic perspective of ensuring that those of color have less, that as this country continues to become browner, I think that window of opportunity for us to understand our competitiveness and the fact that we really are all in this together, that the growing of wealth or assets for people of color is really about the benefit for everyone regardless, that this economic time and place is where we either understand that we will begin to benefit all or we will begin to hurt all. And that's the window of time I'm not sure that people begin to understand, both from a systemic standpoint as well as what it does in institutional structural racism at an individual level.
Diane, you had about 30 civic leaders at the Aspen Institute seminar to discuss racial equality. They watched this film and talked a lot about these issues. Did you see their people's perceptions on inequality change?
Yes.
How?
Absolutely. And I will tell you that not just at the Aspen, but because there are relationships that we still maintain and conversations that occurred after that, even people of white privilege who felt like they understood institutional structural racism, they understood the words, they didn't understand, I think as John Powell says in the film, the invisible became visible for them. Because what has happened, that if you are a person of color, regardless of income, you feel the impact of structural and institutional racism in your everyday life. It's different if you're poor and black or Latino, you feel it even worse. But what a number of people of white privilege identify that they got out of the Aspen Institute and continued conversation is they went, oh my God, I didn't realize that repeated assault, that impact of structural and institutional racism happens in terms of policy from an historical perspective when you think about only 2% benefited in terms of post-World War II, in terms of housing 2% people of color, that wealth trajectory continues to impact us now. But even more so, I think one of the most poignant points out of Aspen that a number of people went when they saw the little girl, one of the film clips, that preferred the white doll and understood what that means for children in terms of the continued insult of institutional structural racism. So I would say to you that that host of civic leaders that attended are still even continuing to figure out what they can do more of. And I know we're all at this table, we're there and all digging deeper, but even others who were not actively engaged are now trying to figure out, how do we expand these lens? How do we change the lens both of white privilege and the lens of people of color to understand that this thing that's been invisible is really visible and is hurting us?
I think two things need to be looked at. One, I think that much of what has been done could be undone just by intention. Just as people of color were intentionally penalized for being of color, the banking industry could turn this around tomorrow by reverse redlining, by making property values more valuable in communities that are integrated, as opposed to communities that are homogenous, whether black or white. That could increase wealth overnight for a substantial number of people of color. Secondly, this society is not ready to have a real discussion about race. Not in Baltimore, not in Maryland, not in America. We're not ready to have a real non-emotional conversation about race. And that's what it's going to take to begin to reverse things.
Okay, you give me, Michael, just let me follow up on a couple of things. what would it take to get ready, to be ready? And why would it be a, why would a discussion of race be non-emotional?
I think some of the emotion has to be taken out of it so people can start seeing how the discussion can operate in all of our self-interests, as opposed to just on an emotional level where we're screaming and hollering at each other. The thing that, that has to take place in this country is, first of all, we have to be willing to admit that a race problem still exists. You know, we're still operating on this illusion in 2012 as we were in 1963. In 1963, with the March on Washington, there were two different points of views taken. African Americans viewed the March on Washington as a beginning point to start the real discussion about integration and inequality. White America viewed it as, we've arrived, we have overcome, not we shall overcome, we have overcome. The same thing has happened in 2008 with the election of Barack Obama. White America, we've arrived. Black America said, no, this is a starting again, a new starting point. And that's where we find ourselves as a country. We're not ready to have a real discussion about what race has done in this country and continues to do in this country.
Just pick up on a couple of things that Diane said, and then what what Bishop was just saying. I think there are some opportunities now that are different historically in that there's a renewed interest in the cities, partly precipitated by the fact that the suburbs, it becomes harder and harder for them to work in terms of traffic and so forth. As energy costs go up, there's a renewed interest in the cities. So there's a possibility of creating a city that comes together that actually is racially integrated and that has, there is wealth formation that occurs as opposed to it being yet another chapter of exclusion on the basis of race. So I think that's a real possibility. I think there are real possibilities around education now, I think, that are connected to this. I just came from a forum where we're trying to get the money to do all of the take all of the buildings, school buildings in Baltimore City, and bring them up to 21st century standards, which is something that can be done and would have an enormous impact on the educational performance of our students and on the attractiveness of neighborhoods. And then the third thing that I think is an opportunity, picking up on this question about our reluctance or our unreadiness as a society to have an honest conversation. I think there's some interesting work, and John Powell's latest book kind of gets into this, that has come out of the study of brain science that allows to really show that there are these patterns of racialization, there are things that are happening subconsciously that people are not necessarily individually choosing to do or responsible, they just are. And there's a possibility of having a conversation there that is, I think it's very emotional in the sense of realizing what's at work, but it is not in the in a sort of sense of a personal, it doesn't get shut down by the sense of personal guilt or refusal to try to engage the conversation. So I think there's a new dialogue that we need to have. And I think the science is actually giving us some ways to have that.
I just want to take a minute to remind folks that you've got about 8 minutes to write any further questions that you have, and our folks will be happy to pick them up. Our producers are taking a walk down the aisle to get your questions. On WYPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast, and I'm with an audience in the Wheeler Auditorium of the Pratt Central Library in Baltimore. We've just watched the documentary Race, the Power of an Illusion, and we're discussing it with Diane Bell McCoy, President and CEO of Associated Black Charities, Bishop Douglas Miles, Clergy Co-Chair of Baltimoreans United in Leadership Development, or BILD, and Michael Sarbanes, Executive Director of Baltimore City Public Schools Office of Engagement. I want to pick up on this point about what John Powell, the noted scholar, a point he made in the documentary, that the benefits of the system very often accrue to people who have not taken any personal action to harvest them. They just flow to them.
White privilege.
I mean, first of all, do you all agree with that?
Very definitely.
That's how the system works.
Very definitely.
Yeah, and I think there's a wonderful quote from Dorothy Sowell where she says, "I am responsible for the house I did not build, but in which I live." And I think that's sort of the situation that that we find ourselves, particularly white people, find themselves in, is figuring out what do you do with this legacy.
So there's kind of an inertia from the perspective of people who have that privilege. It's part of, I think, what you were talking about when you were saying, Diane, that some of the people at the seminar reacted like, oh my God, I didn't realize that.
I mean, I think this is a very complicated issue. And you know, I love the conversation. I love the lines between us. But I also just want to be clear. It's so complicated in terms of there's no one single answer. So as I say that, I think for the people at Aspen and for otherwise, I think it's you don't know what you don't know. And so if you come from a standpoint and your world is one of privilege and you don't know somebody else's world, you have no idea because your lens are just based upon your experience, your exposure, and all the systems around that cater to you. So it's so deep because that means the policies that our country develops that are largely developed by white people of privilege and often male, as our Congress is an example of that, that it's those you have no sense of the world that this policy is impacting that goes beyond who you are. But that's true even in our local areas, why it's important to find, as Bishop Miles describes, to find that common agenda, and I think that common agenda, as I said, has got to be around the economics of it, because there are clear solutions available right now at a state level. Even beyond education, when you think about, if you look at data, even when you think about the fact that African-American businesses provide and hire low-skill African-Americans at a greater rate than non-African-American businesses. Now, that's not rocket science, and that's not duh. But the reality of that, if you look at the numbers, this state is lifted up as having a great MBE and wonderful minority business program. But the greatest number of minority businesses are single ownership. They're not rich in terms of employees. It is vastly limited when you look at white businesses. And when you go deeper than that, what grows businesses? Relationships is a part of it. Not just the wealth, access to capital from banks, that's critical, but relationships. And if the power and the privilege of whiteness allows for that continued access, then what does that mean about growth in terms of wealth? But you can take that same conversation and share it in higher education, in terms of African-American students that despite going to college, don't graduate as first generation across this state and across this country. You can look at this issue in terms of the disproportionate amount of African-American males incarcerated, despite the level of crime they commit is less than white crime. When you look at every one of that collectively, not individually, then we've got to say, this is not happenstance. And we've got to understand that solutions are available to us, but we've got to change our lens and understanding of the problem. Because I don't think we know what the problem really is that leads us to where we are today.
But changing that lens, Bishop Miles, I mean, you say we have to understand there's a problem to discuss it.
We have to understand.
And yet as John Powell points out in the documentary, most of the beneficiaries, most of the people who benefited from this system, are blissfully unaware of how it built up over the last few generations, let alone the previous ones. How do we get to the point of what you say is sufficient awareness?
Again, it's by being intentional, and being intentional of reversing what has taken place, and we need to stop falling into traps of misinformation. For one of the greatest lies that has been told is that the war on poverty didn't work. Yes, it did. It created a black middle class. And as soon as the war on poverty was abandoned, African Americans in this country started retrogressing because the intent that was put in place there to level the playing field was yanked out from the African American community. When I talk in terms of taking the emotion out of it, when you look at Baltimore, there are two Baltimores. Well, let's take the emotion out of that and start looking at it from a self-interest standpoint. As downtown is redeveloped, if nothing is consistently done uptown, then downtown will continue to shrink and all of us suffer. If there's intent to develop the neighborhoods, to increase opportunity in the neighborhoods, to increase better housing stock in the neighborhoods, then all of Baltimore prospers. So there has to be intent, and that's what's lacking in American society today, the intent to reverse the damages of the past.
I would love to take some questions, but I don't have any given to me yet.
While you're waiting for questions, I do want to add a point to what Bishop Miles says in your question around how do we have the intentionality of the conversations both here in Baltimore and across the state. I do think that there are more opportunities available. Michael can talk about one that he's a part of in terms of a faith effort. I think that the lines between us, I know that our work is related to that. I know that the Baltimore Racial Justice Action Network, which is here, who's been in business for 10 years as a way to get white people to begin to talk to each other and understand that, and black people in that collective leadership. They provide opportunities. I know with OSI, I think there are more efforts bubbling to begin to surface this on top of the table and not have it just in our living room sofa and kind of behind closed doors.
Yeah, I'd just like to lift up. I mean, one of the things, and I think there's many efforts like this going on, but the Episcopal Diocese of Maryland has committed to everybody in leadership positions in the diocese going through a two full day training called Seeing the Face of God in Each Other, which really goes into these issues and gets to a lot of depth. Actually use this documentary as one of the materials. We've had about 200 people go through that in the last year in positions of leadership in various institutions. So as that kind of effort happens, I think it is being made more visible, the issues, and different solutions and different actions are coming out of that.
One of our friends here asks this question, and maybe this is what I've been groping to ask also. Why should structural racism matter to those who benefit from it?
Because I really, it's a short term, because they don't benefit from it. When you do the numbers, when you run the math in terms of economically, what are we paying for the price of structural and institutional racism in terms of its impact, in terms of cost of incarceration versus the cost of employment. When you run the numbers in terms of what it yields, in terms of what it costs government to support, when you really look at the total, add up the numbers of what structural and institutional racism is costing us as a country to house and to do, it's not worth it. It really isn't. So it really is changing and understanding beyond personal racism, beyond that conversation, understand the economic impact of it. And then you understand it's hurting you even if you are white.
And I think that it's larger than just racism. I think classism plays a tremendous part, because by class there are people who are benefiting from the structural racism. The 1% benefits from structural racism. The 4% benefits from structural racism. And if we try to deny that, then I think we start off from a point of not honestly addressing. Somebody is benefiting from it, or else it wouldn't exist. And it exists because people make money off of racism. The whole criminal justice system and how racially motivated that presently is, where jails are built nowhere and are built and predicated upon African American failure of young people before they reach third grade. That's somebody's benefiting. Banks benefit from redlining when they can charge me three times what a house is worth and know that I'll pay it because I have no other option. So somebody is benefiting from it. And what has to happen is that the majority of us have to say to those who are benefiting, and in the process, all of us get stuck. You know, white America below the 1% needs to understand you're being taken advantage of too.
Right.
You're being shafted
right.
just as much
right.
as I'm being shafted.
Right.
And until we come to the understanding right. that we've got to work together for our common good,
right.
then this will continue to happen in America.
Right.
Bishop Miles, you mentioned a minute ago the war on poverty and that it worked. Someone asks, can there be a regeneration of affirmative action, a reestablishment of it, or rather, what takes the place of affirmative action?
Real affirmative action.
Could you explain?
As opposed to what was billed as affirmative action, and what many whites now call affirmative action was really not affirmative action. It was taking down the barriers of discrimination.
Yes.
You know, I resent it when people say that I went to Hopkins as an affirmative action student. I had 600 colleges across this nation seeking me. You know, I graduated sixth in my class, a class of 666. I had options beyond Hopkins. I went to Hopkins as an effort to further integrate Hopkins for other African Americans in Baltimore. So I resent it when people say I was there as an affirmative action admission. Affirmative action in the beginning just meant leveling the playing field and understanding that 300 years of having to be better than just to get to where other folks used as a starting line was nothing more than just leveling the playing field. It was not giving me or my race any substantial advantages. It was just removing the disadvantages. And I get emotional, so hey.
And I love that you do. And let me, since you've raised emotion again, let me get back to that for a minute, because I can only imagine how emotional it is for somebody who hasn't been on the benefit receiving end of being white. I've been white my whole life. But even for me, I mean, part of what I thought was powerful in the documentary was Beverly Tatum pointing out that, you know, to the kid of a lower middle class parents who never could afford to go to college and save money and, you know, looks to me like my parents were doing all the right things. And so it's emotional to say, yeah, but it was part of a system that unfairly advantaged me. This is pretty emotional.
Yes. Yeah. You know, almost Bishop Miles and I were talking earlier about this in terms of, and I looked at this as, is this an opportunity even for a city like a Baltimore in terms of whether we, when you look at some of the African countries in terms of the reconciliation hearings and the reconciliation conversations, because there has to be a way for us to start at the emotional level and then go above it. Because we all have a personal set of emotions and at stake for this. But then we have to also set a space and a table and a set of tables that people can have the conversation and feel safe in having the conversation. But people have to start where they are. And where they are is going to be full of powerful emotions for those that have been impacted in a negative way and for those that discover, aha, I didn't do anything for this, but I got it. And should I feel bad about it? You know, we've got to set a table and tables to let the emotion come out, but to let it be okay to go past that emotion.
And I think one of the things that comes out when we do the trainings with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission with the Episcopal Diocese is that over the course of this several days, you really reach a point where, for many of the white participants, they reach a point where the situation that they're in, as they now can see it, becomes intolerable. They can't stay in the situation that they're in. They need to be in a position of taking action on it. And I think that's where the great power of the emotion that people really do, I think, fundamentally want to do the right thing, and they want to be good, and they also want to be in community with others across racial lines. When it becomes clear, when the patterns of racialization, how that happened, how the history occurred, where that's ended up, I think it gets people in a space, they say, okay, this is not an acceptable situation. What do we do about it? And they really start moving towards action. That's the opportunity in the conversation.
We have some specifics that have been raised by members of our audience here. Michael, how can Baltimore schools address the geographic segregation described as the generational result of racist public policy in the film?
So in part of my career, a lot of the work that I was doing was around inclusionary housing in a regional context. And the framework that we used, and we really relied on John Powell in this, was looking at an opportunity map of the region. Like, where is opportunity with the sort of various factors, educational opportunity, economic opportunity, average commute time to jobs, all these different factors sort of layered on. One of the really powerful things that can happen is as the schools in the city improve, and the improvements in the last 5 years have really been historic, that map begins to change, and the possibilities of having more and more neighborhoods be places where, in a regional context, people would say, well, I want to go to that neighborhood. And housing markets that historically have been completely segregated housing markets can begin to become more integrated housing markets, thereby producing greater wealth, right, for the people who are there now. And there's a chance to actually reverse some of this pattern that occurred. The schools, I think, play a critical role in that. There's a sort of a bootstrapping process where, by the incredible effort of teachers and principals and parents and kids, that quality is, you can have major improvements in the quality of schools, and then that has impacts across the board in terms of what happens in neighborhoods and just the sheer opportunities that children have to go on to higher education, to be college and career ready, and to succeed. So I think the schools are an absolutely necessary engine to this. I don't think the schools by themselves are sufficient, but the schools are absolutely necessary to reverse the pattern.
And I probably should have asked this first. The gentrified neighborhoods in Baltimore are, I believe, historically white. Canton, Federal Hill, Fells Point. Have any black neighborhoods gentrified?
Well, there's some interesting history in that there are parts of what's now called Federal Hill that was the oldest African-American neighborhood in the city.
Premise of that question,
well,
we needed
the premise. You have to tie in a lot of complicated things around what happened with eminent domain and the construction of the road and so forth. So I think it is, there has been more growth in areas that are historically perceived to be white. That's probably true, although many of those areas actually have become non-white areas. And there is interest, and there is sort of, I think, more flexibility, certainly than there used to be,
right. But I think
in terms of people coming in.
I'm gonna answer the questions, no.
If it's gentrified and it's black, it's a ghetto. I mean, that's just a reality. I don't care what the income level is. Ashburton, which is largely an African-American middle-class, upper-middle-class community, is not a community that a white middle-class family would opt to move into if they moved to Baltimore. They would go to Fells Point.
And the same house in that same neighborhood can be the exact same house in a white neighborhood in Baltimore. And I believe at one time the property value of that house is almost like half of what it would be in a white neighborhood. And that clearly is still the product that we just saw in the film.
Gentrified means white privileged. It does not mean just privileged. It means white privileged in America.
I'm not sure what's behind this question, so I'm just going to ask it straight. Can you identify an example of a public policy in Baltimore that is continuing or increasing racial inequality?
Where do you want me
to
begin?
Go for it.
I have a document of public policies.
I was a part of a focus group at Hopkins where we were talking about health disparities in Baltimore. And I ran the litany of health problems in the African-American community just in Baltimore. And the researcher got a little bit peeved when I said, this would not be allowed to happen in any white community in America. The African-American community in Baltimore has the highest age rate, the highest other sexually transmitted disease rate, highest hypertension rate, cancer rate, highest infant mortality, chance of dying before you're 70. This would not be allowed to happen in any white community in America. It would be declared a crisis. So when you talk about policy, I mean, we can talk about the policy in terms of development and where development dollars go and to whom the development dollars go. You can talk about education. So that, I mean,
let me give you concrete. Michael just talked about where it just came from in terms of the conversation around the school buildings here in the city. And I think it's something like they did the study, like 90% of the school buildings are in poor condition in the city. Now, there's a state policy that's in place around construction funding in terms of equitable construction funding. And that equitable is never been defined in terms of equity. But so the city is trying to go after this flexibility in terms of the money coming in. But that policy sitting inside, actually for the schools in Baltimore City, where the data shows that school, the condition has actually negative health outcomes. That's number one. And you know that in terms of that building. We know that in terms of all the laws, all the policies around what a building should have in terms of healthy. We know that in terms of that same policy, in terms of what that does in terms of the quality of the school education as it relates to long-term economic outcomes. That's direct impact of policy. Policy at the state level that was enacted as though it had no racialized lens. But in fact, the intent, the impact of that is to create what we have in terms of inequity.
Looking at education again, how many in this audience would admit to being 60 or older? If you do, you remember when the schools in Baltimore, when people in the county would lie about their address to get their children in Baltimore City schools. Anyone remember that? Okay. What happened? As the system became more black, the city and the state divested the Baltimore City school system. Rather than investing in it to keep it where it was, money was taken out. One of the mayors hailed as being one of the greatest mayors in the history of the country. Went through and did a reduction in force in Baltimore City in the 1980s. And hundreds of highly qualified teachers, what we're craving for now in Baltimore, hundreds of highly qualified teachers were laid off mid-year. Textbooks were being housed in warehouses rather than being put into class. This was all public policy. And it operated to the detriment of the African-American community as the city became blacker and blacker.
Just to pick up on the one of the questions that we get at the these community forums that we're doing on the 10-year facilities plan, almost inevitably in every conversation, is people say, how did it get so bad? And the way in which money has flowed over the years in terms of really being focused on areas where there was growth in terms of school construction over decades, which was primarily in the suburbs, is one of the things that happened with it. At the same time, the wealth base of the city, with all the dynamics that the film went over, was getting less and less. So we're at a point now where the amount of money, the city gives about the same amount relative to its wealth base as other jurisdictions, but the amount of money that comes for school construction from local sources in Baltimore is about a tenth of what it is in other large jurisdictions in the state. So there has been an attempt to try to get some more money in recent years to try to go into school construction in the city, but what we're really trying to do now is something on a scale that would allow Baltimore City to actually have the best 21st century buildings in the state, and that would help to reverse this because it has a profound impact on health and on achievement.
I want to also say just kind of quick examples in terms of employment side, the, again, state policy in terms of pushing back on ban the box, in terms of you check the box, in terms of whether you're ex-offender, in terms of sick leave, which is a big policy issue coming up this year in the legislative session, around most of those workers that don't get paid sick leave in this state are largely African-American and Latino and the service industry. There's a litany of policy issues that are in place right now that have the unintended consequences of impacting negatively on African-American, Latino, and other people of color, because the people that develop the policy don't see through the lens of the people it's going to impact.
One of our audience members wants to add a question about mental health to what we've been discussing. Given behavioral outcomes in public schools lacking mental health wellness to identify and empower our youth with capacity building in this area, what will it take to address this problem for all races?
So, well, I think there's two things, if I understand some of what's in the question. One is what happens in schools around addressing mental health. And a lot of that is around specific services and around having sort of cultures in schools and practices in schools that really help to identify when students are struggling and get them connected with the resources and get their families connected with the resources. And that's, there's a lot of work that is ongoing on that. The other thing, just on the mental health question, I mean, one of the most significant findings in terms of when families were able to relocate from neighborhoods of concentrated poverty to neighborhoods of higher opportunity in the region, one of the biggest differences was in terms of mental health outcomes. It was dramatic in terms of the improvement in mental health outcomes when families were able to get out of situations of concentrated poverty and get into neighborhoods where they weren't dealing with all those that toxic stress all the time.
You lessen the impact of structural and institutional racism that is impacted on individuals and families day in and day out living in extremely poor neighborhoods.
There's another element that somebody here wants to add. As the housing industry has caused the concentration of low-income minorities in urban centers, how has public policy pertaining to drug criminalization and rehabilitation furthered this discrimination at the present day?
I'm turning to Bishop Miles.
The whole scam of the war on drugs. The war on drugs in this country does not work. It has not worked. It will not work. And both political parties have bought into that concept of this war on drugs. It's really a war on poor people. And it plays out that way. Again, when you have a jail that has to be filled, somebody has to fill it. And in Maryland, we've made the decision that there are certain regions of the state where the economic engine driving those regions are the jails. And if the jails are built, they have to be filled. And so the war on drugs, going after persons who are minor possessors of drugs, those who have not done anything violent, and putting them in jail, all of that plays into this whole craziness that's going on in this country centered around the drug culture. And until we recognize that this war on drugs does not work and start investing in people, investing in making people whole, and along that whole spectrum of mental health. The African-American community in most major cities are communities in grief. Children grieving over the loss of parents, from AIDS, from drugs, from incarceration, from broken families. Males grieving over the lack of opportunity. Women grieving over the lack of opportunity for them and for their families. And then a child sees his cousin killed on Friday. He gets to school on Monday, and the first thing he's asked for is his homework. And he's never given opportunity to unpack the pain that he or she has felt. So all of this plays together, and it plays back largely to this crazy war on drugs.
Let me raise in particular the jail issue that seems to be at hottest boil in Baltimore right now. And there's been a bit of a public schism among groups trying to stop the state from building a new jail for juvenile offenders charged as adults. Adam Jackson is the CEO of a group called Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. He took to Twitter to protest what he calls the nonprofit industrial complex, for overlooking grassroots work that groups do in trying to lay groundwork for transformative change, like the potential stopping of the youth jail. He tweeted, quote, "We should not put that power in the hand of white people who have no stake in the hood," he said. And I guess my question is about people who do not live in the neighborhoods where inequality plays out most intensely. Do they have different roles to play than those who are trying to improve these neighborhoods from the inside?
I would say yes, but I would also say, because I know Adam, and lots of, I think the importance of moving forward, and I'm not talking about the jail, but any movement where you're asking a group of diverse people from diverse background, and you need all of that. You need grassroots organizers and citizens engaged in it. You need people with influence. You need that. We can't do this unless we stop and make sure we come together with a set of clear values that we all share, clear kind of rules of engagement we all share, clarity around what we're collectively going after, clarity about roles, and some oversight that we self-impose in terms of how we're in this together. And absent of that for any movement in this country, and absence of that, then you have fragmentation that will continue to occur. And I think that's critical to respect and value every member of a movement. And when that doesn't happen, then you will have fragmentations.
Bishop Miles, you look like you want to jump in.
No, I just agree. I just hope that the jail doesn't get built. I don't care who takes the credit. that's the most important thing to me, that those resources could be much better spent investing in our young people, especially in a time when we're closing recreation centers, cutting funding for after-school programs, not building affordable housing for young families. Those dollars could be put to much better use. There's something wrong in a society when you've got a jail called baby booking. There's something wrong.
Right.
And that's what the current place is called, and if that new one is built, it's going to be called the same thing, and it just becomes a place to warehouse our young people rather than giving young families and the children of this city a decent shot at life.
I want to agree with Bishop Miles, but I do want to add, when we have fractions, it allows the goal we're after not to occur.
Yes.
That's the reality. When we have fractions, we may all think we want that goal, but the very people that have an investment in us not getting it will continue to win,
Yes. And
we won't get there.
Let me close with a question from someone here who is addressing not just this particular fight, but the larger question. Solutions to a large extent depend on getting past white resistance. What do you believe is the most effective way to do that? First of all, do you believe that that's essentially the situation we're in, getting past white resistance, and if so, how?
I think it's larger than that, and let me get on my soapbox for just 2 minutes. I think we baby boomers are going to have an awful lot to answer for. We were the best educated, best fed, most privileged generation in the history of this nation, and we have abdicated responsibility for leading this country to a different plane than where it currently is. We fell into the trap of the meism of the 1980s, and we're now reaping the whirlwind from that. And so I think that it's going to take all of us, those of us with gray in our hair, to reinvest ourselves for the next 10 to 15 years to the ideals that we said we had in the 1960s. If we had maintained the zeal of the 1960s and the high goals that we set then we would not be where we are now in terms of race and a whole lot of other stuff that's going on in this country. I look at the Occupy movement. Our young people know that something's drastically wrong in this country, and that's what that movement was saying. And those of us who had experience in organizing and helping them to focus their angst stood on the sidelines and allowed our babies to be literally brutalized and discouraged from participating in changing this nation. So I think that that's where it begins. It begins with those of us with gray in our hair, who are now grandparents, to get back out in an active in helping to create the solutions that are necessary to change this country.
I agree with Bishop Miles, but I would also add, we also have to make sure we make space at the table for that next generation that is passionate, that cares about it, because they have a different perspective to add, and it is their world that we're talking about.
You're offering advice and understanding that advice doesn't have to be taken.
Right.
But we have experience. We have a track record of being able to accomplish certain things. And we can offer some advice to help direct the energy that's resident in young people.
Michael, I'll give you the last word if you can do it briefly.
No, I think that one of the opportunities is to really make the systems of advantage that we were talking about in the film, to make those visible, and then to make all of us together accountable for changing that at every generation and at all these different levels, at levels of policy and at levels of relationship and at levels mm-hmm. of actual personal connection, because we are deeply personally and emotionally invested in making mm-hmm. The society we're in much more just, infinitely more just than it is right now.
I want to thank our guests, Diane Bell McCoy, President and CEO of Associated Black Charities, Bishop Douglas Miles, organizer of Baltimore's Koinonina Baptist Church, and Michael Sarbanes, Executive Director of Baltimore City Public Schools Office of Engagement and Co-Chair of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of the Episcopal Diocese of Maryland. Thank you.